G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
It's great to have the company of one of the most learned men in the history of the world, Adam White, who loves getting up on a Monday and joining us for a chat on the Breakfast Club. Whitey, good morning.
Good morning, Harf. How are we today?
Yeah, going great.
Oh, it's fantastic, isn't it?
Fantastic.
What a time to be alive.
Isn't fantastic. It ever? Isn't it ever? Just brilliant. Just brilliant. Pleased about that.
Well, as you said last night on your social media platform, for you and I, our lives don't really change, do they? But things have just gone a little bit pear-shaped. But that's okay. There's plenty of sport to talk about. We'll distract everybody with heaps of sport and heaps of stuff to talk about.
We will, and that's our job, and that's what we do. And we take great pride in that, to be able to just distract you from the everyday stresses of the world at the moment. We, of course, are in day one of stage four lockdown in Victoria. Nobody wants to be here, but we are. So we'll just get you through it as best we can here in the Breakfast Club and take your mind away from that and put you back into the world of sport. Well, let's be honest, that's where we all want to be. Anyway, one man who knows that better than most is Adam Ramanauskas, Bombers champion, a premiership player with the Bombers, and these days manager to the Stars. And he's back again after a big sporting weekend. Good morning, Rama.
Very good morning. Yes, it was a very interesting day yesterday, but a necessary day, I think. We need to get ahead of this now, and hopefully this is the answer.
That's true. And quite seriously, and we have talked about this through the journey, but we hope everyone is okay out there and coping all right. And we know there's a lot of stresses going through a lot of people in lots of areas at the moment with family and work and health and all that sort of stuff, and we hope you're going okay. If you want to jump on the line and chat to us at any time, we are welcome to do so, 1-300-652-927, and we'll be here to have a chat to you as well, even if it's outside the world of sports. So we are here as a service to you, as well as a chance to talk about sport and get you involved in that conversation and take your mind off things. But if you need a chat, 1-300-652-927 is the number to call. Such a big weekend in the world of sport, Whitey. There's so much stuff going on. We had a big motorsport weekend, which we'll talk about shortly. We had the Super Netball weekend kick off, and our girls are in action. The Pies versus the Vixens yesterday, and a good game of netball as well. Can you talk to Sherelle this week as well about the 2-point shoot zone? Did you see that on the weekend?
Yeah, I did.
It was much bigger than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, but I also don't understand why they've got to get into that sort of rainbow-shaped thing. I kind of thought that if it was outside the circle, it was 2 points. So you could really go from downtown if you wanted to get the 2 points. But you actually had to be inside that thick semicircle band. Yeah, that's a good way of describing it. But I've got to say, I enjoyed it. I think a lot of people who may have been cynical about it enjoyed it as well. But one thing that did happen was that there were a lot of blowouts, which is exactly what Sherelle said would happen. So, yes. Yeah, it'll be interesting to talk to her about whether she's changed her mind on it. Or, because as I said, I know some have. But it was a talking point. That's not a bad thing.
What did you make of it, Rama?
Oh, it was different. It was, you know, something that, yeah, obviously we haven't seen before. So, but I didn't mind it. I didn't mind it. I don't think it'll stay though, because the traditionalist of the game, as they should, will say, well, you know, this is not part of our game. Has never been a part of our game. It's like when they had the super goal in football. There were some people that really loved it and thought, oh, geez, this is exciting. Whitey would have absolutely loved the super goal, but there was others that said, no, this is fiddling, this is messing with our game. So, I didn't mind it. For an added layer to the game, I didn't mind it at all.
Yeah, it was interesting. And it's a great opportunity for branding and for sponsorship leverage if they want to get some more details on the court. That's a great opportunity. Yeah. It was a bit broader and closer than I thought it might have been. Now, I'm with you, Whitey. I thought it was going to be a little band outside the arc, the D, as they call it in netball, and shoot from long range if you want. But it was a bit closer than that. So one of the players, I can't quite remember her name, Rama, was 10 from 11 from range.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was wondering, what the percentages were overall for the weekend from range.
I'll get you that. I know that stat. I'll find that for you in a second.
One thing that was interesting, Rammer, is that some teams used it a lot. Other teams chose not to use it very much. And even if you look at the Vixens-Magpies game, the Vixens had double the shots to what the Magpies had. Now, the Vixens won quite comfortably, and it wasn't the only reason that they won the game. But that was, I think, one of the interesting things. So, yeah, I mean, look, it was a talking point. And I think that in such a crowded sporting schedule as we have, and we often talk about that, it did get people talking. And I know, particularly in netball land, a lot of debate, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. Was it a gimmick? Is it a gimmick? I'm not sure. I can understand both sides of the argument.
Here you are, Rama. Efficiency and for the super shot, as they call it in Suncorp Nepal. The Lightning were 11 from 13, 85%. Fever were 73%. The Giants were 72%, 13 from 18. Thunderbirds 10 from 15, 67%. Magpies 6 from 9, 67%. Firebirds 6 from 12, 50. The Vixens 10 from 20. Took a lot of shots, but didn't make many, 50%. And the Swifts were 8 from 17, 47%. So if you put all those together, which I'll do for you shortly, you'll get around about 60%, I reckon.
Yeah, which is not bad. The only thing I will say is, watching the NBA over the weekend, the amount of three-point shots is just absolutely ridiculous. How many three-point shots are now taken in the NBA? You hope that netball doesn't turn that, if they continue on with the two-point shot, you hope netball doesn't turn that way. Also, talking about, well, if you're a certain distance out, you're better off taking the two-point shot because the percentages are similar. So you don't want it to turn into that style of game. You know, I used to love the NBA when you saw more dunks and you saw more three-pointers. Now, you know, you're seeing more three-point shots and two-point shots within the NBA. And it's, you know, it does get tiresome sometimes the way teams are playing, particularly Houston.
The three-ball game is the game at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you go ISO, you can do the ISO game if you want and get your gun out there and just open the floor for them and let them go to work, which is what happens if you got LeBron on your team or one of those, Kawhi, Giannis, one of those sort of type players, Giannis, Antetokounmpo. But if you haven't, the three-ball game is quite significant in the world of the NBA.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I love the NBA. I did enjoy it. I didn't enjoy watching the Rockets play, obviously, like I said. That was, I think, 150 to 145, I think the scoreline was, against the Mavericks on the weekend, something ridiculous like that. And I know it went to overtime, but it just doesn't... The game doesn't feel natural when they're shooting that many three-pointers. But from another point of view, Whitey, and watching the NBA as a spectacle and how they've done it with the virtual fans on the weekend and the noise and the atmosphere, I liked it. It didn't seem too different to me from obviously being at the arenas. The players are playing at a really good intensity at the moment. So, yeah, I enjoyed the weekend's NBA.
Yeah, and, I mean, the baseball's continuing. There's another team, unfortunately, St. Louis, that have got some issues with coronavirus.
The Phillies also.
The show goes on. Yeah, the show goes on. So I think one of the interesting things with the basketball that we can sort of relate it back to AFL football is this whole thing around crowds. Because what we saw on the weekend, that arguably the two best games involved big crowds, West Coast and Geelong on the Saturday night, and then last night Fremantle and Collingwood. And did the home crowd get those teams over the line or help them get them over the line? And, you know, whether that's umpiring decisions, whether it's just the emotion attached to riding the crest of an emotional wave, we haven't seen it for a while. It's been quite neutralised, that sort of thing. But both West Coast and also Fremantle came from behind to win. Now, that hasn't been happening statistically in AFL football throughout the course of the year. So I think that was one of the really interesting layers over the course of the weekend when it comes to Australian football.
Yeah, and I think crowds, particularly home crowds, help with momentum. When you've got some sort of momentum, it continues on probably for another couple of minutes or at least another goal, whereas when there was obviously no crowds and no crowd noise there for players, that momentum, it didn't feel the same. It just didn't feel like the players were were using it to get themselves over the line, to push themselves that little bit harder. But clearly West Coast on Saturday night against Geelong were using that. And you could see the momentum. That momentum just carried on. And then obviously last night, Fremantle, I thought it was a masterclass from Justin Longmuir in coaching. Obviously, he knows Collingwood and their system very, very well. But how he was able to shut them down on so many occasions last night was excellent.
Yeah, no doubt. A bit of intel from inside the camp helped Fremantle yesterday, but they were hungry. They were fast and hungry and good, weren't they? They played a nice brand of footy, and the Pies had no answer, which was very, very interesting. The last couple of weeks, Perth hasn't been good to the Pies in many ways, on and off the field.
Fremantle were off the charts with the pressure gauge.
The boys would have been happy with that. The boys would have been happy with that, your boys.
Yeah, well, I was told, because they were talking about how, in the coverage, that they're off the charts and the pressure gauge. And Campbell said that it was the second highest reading for the year that he'd noticed, that it wasn't the highest. And he actually told me who the highest one was, and I now can't remember what it was, but he said it was the second highest. Anyway, can I just say, and I want to get this out early, and we'll talk obviously to Jimmy about this later on when we go through the round of footy, but Hawthorn's in crisis. Maybe they're not after their win on the weekend. But Hawthorn has won the same amount of games as Collingwood. And we think of Fremantle as being a top... we talk about Fremantle being a bottom four team. Collingwood has only won one more game than Fremantle. Collingwood's lost four of their last six games. Now, I know they've had a tough draw, and I know their draw sort of opens up a little bit over the next 3 weeks. But the reality is... Yeah, the reality is they have only won one more game than Fremantle. Now, they've got the draw, so it's I'm being slightly facetious in a sense.
It's a buffer.
But having lost four of their last six, something's not right.
Well, it's an interesting time because, I mean, the form ladder tells me that they've had the second hardest draw. That's what the form ladder tells me.
And they have had a tough run.
But the form ladder also tells me that Carlton have had the third hardest draw. They've won as many games as the Magpies.
Yeah,
so,
well, that's
so
right.
It's going to be... Tell you what it's going to do, the back end of this season. What are we? Just over halfway now. Officially, just over halfway. It will compress again to the ladder because Port Adelaide have had the second easiest draw, I think it is. No, they've had the fourth easiest draw. Brisbane have had the second easiest draw. St Kilda have had the third easiest draw. So the teams that are sitting up high, I think Brisbane are a bit of an outlier. Brisbane and Port are a bit of outliers here because I think they're pretty good full stop. But they've had the easier draws, so there's going to be a compression of the ladder again, I reckon, in the back eight rounds, Rama, that we'll see teams that are sitting anywhere up to 15th at the moment, 14th to 15th, will climb, and teams that are sitting anywhere below four will start to drop off and even up through that middle of the ladder. And percentage is going to be more important this year than just about ever, I reckon.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. A percentage will be crucial. But just to Whitey's point about Collingwood and Hawthorn, and a little bit different with Fremantle, but it's the way Hawthorn were playing is why I think people were reacting the way they were to form. Now, Collingwood, the game last night obviously could have went either way in the end. The game against Essendon could have went either way in the end. So, you know, there's potentially a couple of more wins. But, yeah, the way Hawthorn were playing... Compare that to the way they played on Friday. Do we call it twilight half or do we call it night?
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, I think we'll call it Friday twilight.
Yeah, perfect.
That was the Hawthorn that I think... That's the blueprint for Hawthorn. Like that game changed when young Will Day took the man on the mark. He took him on and that created all this enthusiasm and excitement amongst the Hawthorn team. And from there, they went on and dominated. Six goals in that second quarter and they were dominating with their ball movement again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what's frustrated me about Hawthorn is we know what they can do and what they have done even this year. But we just haven't seen it. And then you see it in that second quarter and you go, well, where has that been? And if you ask Hawthorn players, they don't know themselves where it went. And it's like they were playing hide and seek with their game plan and they couldn't find it. Like they just couldn't. But the interesting thing, and I want to go back to that point about Hawthorn and Collingwood, one of the key reasons why Hawthorn had lost form and had been criticised was because of their lack of scoring power and that they couldn't score. Now, after nine games, Hawthorn has a four, or this is the accumulation of their points for the year, of 532, and Collingwood's four is 525. So I still believe, in my view, the key issue with Collingwood is their inability to score and their inability to attack appropriately. And Collingwood got into this little bit of a muddle a couple of years ago, the year before they played off in the grand final. And Bucks really released the shackles in that grand final year and let them really improvise and play with instinct when they had their ball in hand. Whereas now I feel like they've gone back into this real muddle whenever they've got the ball. But that's quite damning that if you look at that four of 525, that puts them below teams like even North Melbourne with their four for the year. We think of the Giants not being able to score a lot, particularly if they're inside 50s. Well, they're 60-odd in front of Collingwood. So it's something they've really got to fix, because if they don't, as half said, in a compressed season and a compressed ladder, it could be the difference between them making the finals or not. And we thought them as being a premiership team.
Yeah, last couple of weeks there's been a bit of a reset on that, which I think we'll have these conversations with most teams, I think, at some stage through the year, about a bit of a reset on their expectations, particularly if we think they're going really, really well. No surprise, though, to see from the Hawks' perspective, and this is maybe a conversation for after seven with John, that you look through the best players, Mitchell, Warple, Gunston, O'Meara, Burgoyne, Shields and Bruce. They're their guns.
Yeah,
their guns are, because of the depth in their list, seemingly there's some holes in it between the best and the next generation. Experience in the next generation. If those experienced players don't play well, they are becoming very, very vulnerable. Probably more so than other teams, I reckon.
I've got something on that, but I want to wait to Jimmy to talk about that as to why it changed with Hawthorn and whether it was forced or whether they just went back to playing the way that they wanted to play. Because I think it's a really interesting sort of discussion point.
We'll hold fire on that. John's on the road, wants to talk Geelong and West Coast. Hello, John.
Okay, so just a couple of points. I thought it was a great game to watch, Geelong and West Coast, compared to that garbage Essendon side. And just tell me something, does Moira Swans look interested in coaching anymore? Or to me, it just looks like he's lost his... you remember when he played, mate, tough as nuts. I just think, what's happened? Grill the boys, we kicked three goals. They're pathetic. But the only good positive was Draper. What do you think, boys?
Well, his demeanour doesn't change too often on the bench. So since he's gone down to ground level, yeah, when they always take the camera to him, he always looks cool, calm, and collected. But I agree, John. I'd love to see a little bit more animation from him, particularly when the team is going poorly, as they were on Friday night, when players are coming off. Be demanding. Be, I guess, get in their face a little bit and show some emotion, because I think that then has to come from the coaches that are upstairs at quarter time, half time, or three quarter time. Whereas John's down there, you look at Chris Fagan. On the other hand, he's standing up. He looks like he's really involved in the game. He's talking to players constantly. He's encouraging. He's coaching. He's teaching. So yeah, it was very contrasting styles by two coaches on a bench on Friday night.
But Ramo, that John's never been any different, and John's won a premiership being like that. And Ben Rutten's not going to be any different to John Worsfold. And we've seen with Simon Goodwin, he prides himself on not showing any emotion on the bench. So I don't think that's the reason why Essendon is playing the way they are playing. Essendon's playing the way they're playing because they've arguably got the worst forward line in the history of the game.
Stand by, more after seven. Thank you, John, for your call. Sam's in Swan Hill. Hello, Sam.
How are you?
Going well. How are you, mate?
I'm shocking.
Now, what's happened?
I know you haven't got all day, but I want to ask you three questions, please, before you dump me. Nathan Buckley here, don't stand on the fence, Rammer. We're not going to win the flag this year. That'll be 10 years. So the first question to the three of you is, what do you do with Buckley at the end of the year? Now, we've got blokes like Moore, Phillips, even Treloar, who just don't perform when the chips are down. We've got too many C and D graders. If Grundy doesn't perform, we lose. We can't kick goals. Whitey, you answered a lot of my questions. But you then go back and say, oh, you know, we've had honourable losses. As you three guys have always said, you're only judged by premierships, and we aren't going to win one for the next 10 years if we've got Buckley. So, please, what do we do with him?
Rama?
I keep him. I absolutely keep him. I still think and I still believe that Collingwood will be there at the pointy end of the season. Obviously, without their captain, it's very, very difficult. You know, he's been a constant there for 12, 13 years. He's so durable and hasn't missed a game. Collingwood struggle without him. I think when he hasn't played, their percentage is about 40% win to loss. So it's an interesting question about Buckley, because I always say this, right? When a team goes and gets rid of a coach, and then there's this initial excitement, and, oh, great, a new coach comes in, and then the performance is not there, then people turn around and go, well, why did we get rid of Nathan Buckley for you? He was a great coach. So I think there's no doubt that the players are playing for Nathan Buckley. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind. And he's a very good coach. Collingwood, I think, more to the point, what Whitey's trying to make, he's talking about their efficiency through the middle of the ground. Rather than statting up, which some players do quite often for Collingwood, give their forwards a chance. Get the ball forward, give them a chance. They've got such a talented forward line of those, you know, small to medium type players. But when they've led because players are flicking the ball around trying to set up through the middle of the ground, it becomes very hard to score. So I think they need to tweak their game style.
Yeah, and I think if you look at we were talking before about their points, they kicked 49 on last night, then they've gone 45, 57, 59, 48, 64, and then they got 81 against St Kilda, and in that draw they got 36. So I know that Bucks has been a bit prickly about questions around their scoring numbers, because he does pride himself on the defensive numbers. Yep. But that was when they were winning. It is an issue. And I think there's been a number of teams that have lost their way with their ball movement. I think Melbourne falls into that category, Hawthorn, Essendon. And a lot of that, and this is why I'm prepared to give all coaches an out and all teams an out, is that they can't train it. So when they get, and we talked about this last week, Raymond, you said it's not an excuse, but when you can only train in groups of eight and you've got ball movement issues, that you can't actually train on the training track to try and get confidence into the group. It can only be done in game. I think teams are finding it hard to get out of that funk when things aren't working for them.
But didn't they have all someone to do that? Proactively.
Yeah. Well, they did, but you lose confidence. It's like a cricketer that you might have the best pre-season ever, but you get a couple of outs early and all of a sudden you lose your confidence. It's hard to get it back.
But I think there's just teams. I'm not talking about ball movement though, Whitey. I'm talking about skill level. I'm talking about skill level.
But is that a confidence thing as well as being able to train it, you know, hitting targets about bleeding patterns and all that sort of thing? You don't think it's something that would be better if it's been if it's trained appropriately during the week?
Well, again, I don't like going down this path.
But I'm asking you guys that.
So after training, okay, Matthew Lloyd or Scott Lucas would be leading, just practicing their leads. I'd be up through the middle of the ground, scooping up the ball through the middle of the ground, looking up, seeing where they're leading, hitting a target, going inside forward 50. I can do that with two people, myself and the forward. I don't need another 35 players out on the field to be practicing that. I'm talking about simple skill execution, going inside forward 50, hitting an actual target, the money kick half that we always talk about.
Oh, money. Yep. Let's continue this after 7 o'clock. It's a good conversation. And the Magpies are front and centre after a disappointing fortnight in Perth, no doubt about that. And, of course, the Buckley-Sanderson tennis match on the weekend was a little distraction they probably didn't need as well, as part of the protocols for the COVID situation. Not ideal. Tennis, there was some news across the weekend. Nick Kyrgios was making a statement across the weekend on social media. Let's have a listen to the young Aussie.
I will not be playing this year at the US Open. It hurts me at my core not to be out there competing in one of the sport's greatest arenas, Arthur Ashe Stadium. But I'm sitting out for the people, for my Aussies, for the hundreds and thousands of Americans who have lost their lives, for all of you. It's my decision, like it or not. And those are my reasons. Yours sincerely, Nick.
So it was 101 seconds, the video. That's about 20 seconds of it from Nick Kyrgios saying that he won't be heading to the US for the US Open. We know Ash Barty last week announced similar sentiment. Craig Gabriel is our tennis correspondent. In fact, he's the number one tennis correspondent on the planet. And yeah, I just got a feeling that despite the fact there's no tennis, by goodness, he'd be looking good in his Lacoste shirt today. Craig, welcome.
Yes, true. And just before we get onto the tennis, Ryan's mum and dad are long, long, long-time friends of mine, Ray Ruffles and Ana Maria Fernandez. Wonderful people, and they are so proud of their boy.
Well, he's doing great things at the moment. We had a chat to Gabby not too long ago on the program, so the family is very, very well-versed in the world of professional sport. And it seems, as we get it back to the tennis just for a second, the Kyrgios announcement last week, did it catch people off guard? What has been the response to that? So it was only yesterday, I think it was. Craig, what's been the response?
The response is, look, I think a lot of people have said, good on you, and patting him on the back. Some have said, who cares, doesn't really matter with him, and, it's Nick, never mind. But I think because he's got such a high profile, he may not be top 10 at the moment or anything like that. He's, I think, about 40 in the world. He does carry a bit of attention, well, quite a bit of attention when he says anything. And there's been a lot of support for him over the last couple of months with his criticisms of these various exhibitions that have been going on and the irresponsible behavior of so many players and what it's resulted in, with so many of them contracting COVID and Grigor Dimitrov still suffering with it, even though he's now negative. So I think it certainly did draw attention. It did not come as a surprise because he's been suggesting this for quite some time.
Yeah, well, it's the interesting part now from an Australian perspective, Craig, is that our three biggest names in Australian tennis now are not playing the US Open. And we think of Ash Barty, the number one women's player in the world, who I think at this stage she's still likely to play the French but not play the US. And then obviously Sam Stosur, who's won the US Open, she's not going either. How do you think that will be seen sort of on the world tennis stage that the three Australians have made a stand and said no?
Look, I think once things roll around, I don't think it's going to be much of a registration, apart from Ash, with respect to the others. Sam is, even though she has won the U.S. Open in the past, as far as the Americans are concerned, it's all about Serena Williams and doing whatever they can within the rules to see her win major number 24. And that's what will really matter. I think it'll be a bigger talking point if, let's say, somebody like Rafa Nadal decides not to play. He's on the still on the entry list along with Novak Djokovic, and I think that's going to create more attention over there because it'll be closer to the actual event time-wise before something like that happens, and that'll carry over because he's also the men's defending champion. So at the moment, yes, it's drawing attention, but I think closer to the time, it probably will be on the back burner.
So, Craig, we're seeing now with the NBA and what they're doing with the bubble. Now, tennis players basically go into a bubble when they play in a tournament anyway. But what will they do at the US Open? Will they have them in a certain hotel together? How will they try to, I guess... keep all these players and coaches, I imagine, in the one area so that we don't have any positive tests through the Open?
Yeah, well, that's going to be interesting to see how that works. Just before I get onto that, there's a tournament that's just started on the women's event, on the women's tour in Palermo. They already had somebody. I think one of the qualifying women, possibly it could be Victoria Tomova of Bulgaria, who's tested positive. But the tournament's still going on. The WTA didn't even announce her name. They put out a statement to say one player has tested positive, and in my view, they should have scrapped the tournament. But anyway, they're going ahead. Now, as far as the U.S. Open is concerned, initially when they made the announcement they're going to go ahead, they were suggesting that a player would only allow or could only have one other person with them. Well, that's been expanded now to three more. They're allowed. There is a bubble. There's going to be some specific hotels, a shuttle service going back from the to and forth from the hotel and the venue. No players are going to be allowed to go into Manhattan, which is going to be tough for them because that's where they used to be staying. And they've also are also allowing players to rent homes, very similar to what happens during Wimbledon and the grass court season in England. Now, from what I'm hearing, quite possibly that may has and that could have come about because of Serena. She didn't have, she wants everybody around her, and maybe even Novak Djokovic. So we'll see how things work out. But yes, there's going to be a bubble. They originally were going to have airport hotels near Kennedy Airport, and one of them was going to be the TWA hotel. So they realized there's no room service, there's nothing to do over there, the rooms are small, all that sort of stuff. So they've moved, and they're using hotels a little further down Long Island. So, you know, they're going to be very strict. There's going to be constant testing, temperature checks every single day in and out of the tennis center. So fingers crossed, nothing happens as far as anybody contracting things. But you got to also remember, it's not just players and their little entourages. There's all the service people, the limited number of lines people they're going to have. The outside courts are going to have electronic line calling, but then there has to be some catering staff. There has to be those drivers for the shuttles and all those sort of things. So it's going to be a huge logistic nightmare, but they're going to have to be able to do it.
He is a triple premiership player. He's a Brownlow medalist. He's a Norm Smith medalist. And by goodness, he's a handsome man. He's back again. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Half. Morning, everyone. How are we with this festivus of football?
We are all festived out. I'm festived out, Jim, and now I've got to get back up again for tonight.
Yeah, well, look, it'll never end. And I think that's part of when you try and review the round. The problem is that you almost have to go on the Wayback Machine to actually highlight how good Richmond were way back on Wednesday night. They got their mojo back.
Well, they certainly did get their mojo back. It was nice to see him in action in a play at that level. That was one of the performances of the week, or the round, not the weekend, the round with their win over the Bulldogs. Your standout performance, though, Jim, as we go to the highlights of the round, what was your standout performance across the weekend?
Richmond are impressive. Port, I think we expected to be too good for Melbourne, but you know, I think the story out of that was Melbourne capitulated. Hawthorn, were they the standout? Was it Brisbane's dominance? Kangaroos, you'd expect it too good. Probably the West Coast win for me so far. Or Freo knocking over Collingwood, maybe as an underdog, but probably the best match we've seen probably since the resumption of play. Probably West Coast win over Geelong, I reckon, in the end.
How about you guys? It's hard to argue that was not the match of the round, match of the season so far. It was a brilliant game of footy, West Coast and Geelong. And it was two opposing forces meeting together and trying to create get an outcome for either team, of course. And the Cats own that game. Let's start there, because I reckon it was the highlight of the weekend. Let's start there. And the Cats owned that game, Jim, early doors with real possession footy and dragging the Eagles forward. They were sitting back on their heels a bit and dragged them forward and found a way through. It was a tactical arm wrestle, which ended up, of course, with the Eagles winning by 9 points. But I don't think Geelong lose too many fans on the back of that, do they?
No, and I think that it highlighted my point that I've tried to make with Geelong a few times this year when they've been defeated, is this possession style of football. I'm all fine with, if you want to play that, they call it, you know, the real simple terms of kick mark or kick catch football, where you possess it, you take the freeze, you make the opposition defend. Now, that's smart against a side like Richmond. It's also smart against definitely a side like West Coast, who get well set and well structured in defence. They score a lot off turnovers. West Coast do theirs a little bit further back than Richmond. But the reason why I was happy with Geelong is they took the game forward when they're doing it. My angst or annoyance with Geelong is when they do it and they go short to the boundary, sideways, backwards in their back half, and they can't get out. And then you look at what they've got forward. It's not exactly like they're protecting, call it an inexperienced forward line. It's you know, you've got Hawkins, who's in cracking form. You know, for most of the year, it's been Ablett. You know, Parfitt, Menegola, who spent time across half forward, and Gazza. So I think the big difference was they took the game forward and they actually put the West Coast defence under a lot of pressure, and they were able to score off it. Now, they missed some easy shots in the end, the Cats, which probably could have got them the win. But you got to give West Coast credit as well. Their star players, their big-name players, like, kept lifting throughout the game.
Have you seen a performance like Nat Nui? Boys, just across the board, just won. Nat Nui's performance on Saturday night was, I think, the most dominant tap-rucking performance I think I've ever seen, the way he was able to create for his side. Now, I haven't been around for 100 years, but in my time in footy, about 25 years, I don't think I've ever seen a more dominant tap-rucking performance.
Well, I highlighted this for the game against West Coast only the week before. Now, clearances were pretty even, but what he does is the type of clearances they get off the back of Nat Nui are just destructive. And they're one team, and this is what I think we all hope for. When the first time the rules come in, you know, the starting positions, and everyone goes, well, this is Max Gawn, this is Melbourne. Well, I think West Coast have actually worked it out, especially from the centre bounce. And funnily, Chris Scott, I think that quote that's going around again.
Very funny.
The only problem, the only problem is when you kick a goal, it means you bring Nick Nat Nui back into the game. You've got to go back to the centre. It's because because he can hit, it sounds very, very simple, inside and out. If it's a centre bounce crew, you're going, well, I don't know whether they own the space on the inside, the outside, am I covering out wide? But West Coast pull that apart so well. But when Nat Nui jumps and almost over the top of the other ruckman and hits forward, he becomes another midfielder. You watch how many times he gets the clearance when he hits forward. It's almost like he's just pushing it out in front of himself. Now, where the advantage comes there is all your forwards can pull back and dictate, because you can't put the extra defender around the back anymore.
Yeah.
And you can't really just put someone there, all right, cover the back of the stoppage, because they just come blasting through. So that's why, you know, all their forwards have so much space after a centre bounce.
Jimmy, can I go back to the thing about Geelong's ball movement? Because I think it's a really interesting case. In the first half, they lead by 16 points, Geelong, at halftime, and playing really good footy. They were owning the ball, but they were also, as you said, being quite proactive when they had the footy. In the second half, it was West Coast 7-5 to Geelong 3-4. And in the last quarter, it was West Coast 4-1 to Geelong's 1-2. When they start to get really ultra defensive with ball in hand, how does that change? Is that something that needs to be done by the leaders out on the field to sort of say, come on, guys, we're getting too defensive here? Is that a message that comes from the coach? Because it's happened to Geelong a bit that they're doing something really well, but just slowly it starts to get more and more negative to the point where they forget to score.
Yeah, but it's tough to change within quarters, though, Whitey. That's the problem. Half could probably speak to this, is it trying to get the message and across the board and to certain players in particular. I think we've spoken here, but I reckon, Rama, haven't we, the last month, how literal some players we've played with. If you've given them a game plan that, all right, just take the only free available, they'll keep doing that all game, because they'll go, I'm better off not getting in trouble for following the team rules than trying to step outside and play the game. So if they've been in that mindset for the game that let's take the free available, and now if they get it early, well, then they think, oh, well, we've been getting it early, why don't we just keep doing it? But if the opposition adjusts and then you say, oh, I'm still taking the free, but you're actually going nowhere, there's a lot of players who don't think, well, actually, we're better off just taking the contest to Hawkins down the line or Radaglia or whoever it may be.
When Geelong try to save the game, ice the game, whatever you want to call it, they very much become a kick and mark handball team. So they'll kick, mark, kick, mark, kick, mark. Before you know it, they're pushed all the way back. So when they eventually have to kick the ball up the line, it's not close enough to their goals where if the ball does turn over, the team just goes back the other way and it's too easy for them. So they need, take the ball forward if you're kicking and marking rather than going sideways and backwards. Yeah. When you turn the ball over, you're virtually turning the ball over in the opposition's team's forward half. They rebound, they bounce off that, and they're easy to score.
Yeah. So the question for all of you is, with what Geelong did on Saturday night, do they walk away going, that's the template to beat West Coast? Or do they go, we tried it, it didn't work, we've got to do it differently?
Well, it could be different, and it could be obviously it's a bit of a public sell as well, coaches' press conferences. But I took Chris Cott's comments as well. Yeah, we can mix it. We just got beaten, but we're sort of happy with the way we played. And you had some personnel changes in there who can do different things and different roles, and we're fine. I'm not sure whether you guys read it a little bit differently or whether it was just the PR style coach's conference. But what I heard from Chris Scott was, yep, that's it. We convert maybe radically kicks from 15 metres out when we're sort of rolling. You know, some probably different moments in the game, not necessarily the game plan.
I think they walk away with that and know they can beat West Coast. That means up to stadium, really vocal crowd, energy against them. They owned that first half of the game. And my only concern at half time with the Cats, what they did was that it took so much concentration and energy to hem West Coast in that first half and own the ground. It was always going to be hard to maintain that for four quarters. History says you don't do it very often. So that was my concern at halftime, Rama. But I wasn't surprised to see them get run over in the end. I don't think they went too much into their shell. I think the West Coast just upped their ante because they had to score. They had to play and put them under enormous pressure and then started their squeeze. The first half they sat back, then they started to squeeze a bit. I think it was a fabulous game of footy tactically, let alone the contest itself visually from a spectator's perspective. But I think the Cats, with personnel, as Jimmy says, that can come back in, get a much more recognised, I haven't got a super recognised ruckman, but a much more recognised ruckman in to try and limit the influence of Nick through another game, whether it be a final or not. I reckon they go in cock-a-hoop.
They were missing two of their very best surgeons. They've tried to play surgical, so a surgeon always gets tired as they continue the procedure. So as that game continued to go on, you could see Salwood around the contest. Ablett's forward craft was really missing from that team. Now, a 35-year-old Ablett, a 32-year-old Salwood, you're going to say, well, come on, there's got to be other guys that can take over. But those two players are still exceptional players within the competition. So you have Gary in that forward half taking the ball inside forward 50, Jim, and you have Salwood around contest still with his physical presence and nature. That may have been different. That may have not been that scoreline in the last quarter, because the last quarter was really where the issue came for Geelong. They just couldn't sustain it, and not having those two champions there hurts.
Yeah, and I think two players, importantly, who come back into the game, one for each, could actually change the game completely, could make it almost a worse game because of the tactics involved to go around them. So if big Gecko Hands McGovern comes back in for West Coast, he can completely affect your game plan and the structure, the way you play. And on the counter side for Geelong, if they bring in a ruckman, that means Blitzards goes back and plays on Kennedy once he starts running right. I know we highlight Salwood and Ablett, but don't forget West Coast. Jerry McGovern is one of the biggest game plan destroyers our game's had in recent times. Like, he literally, a couple of times, has ruined Collingwood's game plan or whatever other good side, because he's played games where you could literally just walk down and get, let's save everyone some time, just walk down and hand him the footy because sides just keep kicking it to him.
So Geelong walk away from Perth 1-2. But with their percentage still intact, their percentage is still 118. So they're sitting sixth on the ladder. They now go back to the Gabba against North Melbourne on Wednesday. I think they're in a pretty good position still, the Cats. They'll get Salwood back shortly. We're not sure when Gaz is going to go back up and start quarantining to hopefully complete the season. But I think walking away from Perth with a 1-2 record, I don't think they would be happy, obviously, but it's not a disaster.
Well, the form ladder has them being in the bottom half of the eight. That's what the form ladder says. And I think that's about right.
How's your form ladder going with the Demons at the moment?
No, they're still in it. They're still in
how?
It. What do you mean,
it's
how?
It's not a 48-game season.
They'll be 5-5 after the next 2 weeks with a game under their
sleeve.
They'll be 5-5. And all of a sudden,
people have invested in the Demons on this radio station,
just be careful.
That's why they're
just
trying to convince themselves.
They'll be 5-5. Yeah.
Just be
two
careful
weeks.
With what. That's right. Just be careful with what you two say about Melbourne.
Are they hoping for 25 sets of tennis or something? just across the board. They're going to have like a big play-in tournament.
They'll be 5-5 in 2 weeks.
The Demons are coming.
They've had the worst draw by far.
Hey, just on the Demons quickly, if we can.
No, Longley. Do it Longley if you want.
No. Obviously, the president's comments.
Yep.
Firstly, what did you make of them, Jim? And then secondly, as a player, do you listen to them comments?
I think they resonate a bit more, Rama, when it comes from someone like Glenn Bartlett, who we don't hear from. When a president who's not a big either media performer or media presence or is a very conservative sort of president, compared to others, he's not a Koshy, he's not an Eddie, he's not a Tony Cochran and things like that. I think that does make your ears prick up a little bit. This is just me as a footy fan, and I think you wouldn't get four bigger supporters of the D's than us four. We're on the D's bandwagon because we see the potential. But when a president comes out, and normally as a player, you go, it's the president, it's the board, you go, it doesn't really matter. But when he labels you soft and things like that, off the back of David Schwartz, who is a former player, who said you're irrelevant, and then you dismiss him and then you serve up that, I think you got to start looking a little bit at how you're going about your business, don't you, Rama?
Yeah, I thought they were very interesting comments.
You're looking at an angle here. I can see your face. Yeah. You've got an angle with this.
I feel you're doing almost the indoor cricket where you're wiping the back fence ready to come in and bowl. you're like, I'm good.
I just don't know. I don't know if they help at this stage for the Demons. I don't know. What's he trying to do? Is he trying to put them on notice? What is he trying to put the players on? That's the coach's job. Now, it's different. Well, Sheeds would come in, and Sheeds was able to... He was a master with the media, the way he was able to send a message to a playing group or a player through the media. Now, I think a president is always behind the scenes. Now, I know we have a lot of presidents in football now that are involved in media or of some description, but I think that would have had more effect on the playing group if it was actually behind closed doors and directed to them. Now, I know the circumstances don't allow that because they're obviously in Queensland and he's down here in Melbourne, but I think it would have been a more powerful message if he said it to the group rather than saying it through the media.
To the group or to the coach anyway. And would have had a conversation with the coach prior to having that article, that chat with Johnny Ralph in the Herald Sun. I'm surprised that didn't happen. I'm with Jim. I think for a guy like Glenn Bartlett to be so emotional about that performance and to be so strong in his condemnation of it, I think Melbourne fans across the country would have gone, thank God someone said it. And thank God someone of power within that football club has said it. We've been sitting here watching this garbage for too long, and it's finally been said. So, yeah, it is a bit of put them on notice. Absolutely. And so they should be after that performance.
I agree with you. Sorry, Whitey, I'll jump in. But I agree with you. But the problem is Glenn Bartlett's got to speak for the members.
That's right.
But I understand 100% what you're saying. So both of you, I think, are right. But Glenn Bartlett would be getting his phone pinging from corporate supporters and coterie groups and all sorts of things going, where are you, mate? Like that sort of stuff. Yeah. So that's what I took it as.
You know, one of the big problems, Rama, I think, with Melbourne is a bit around Simon Goodwin, and he's so emotionless. And we took a call earlier this morning from John about John Worsfold and how passive it looks like he is. Now, this is just a perception thing, but it felt to me and it feels to me that Melbourne needed a circuit breaker. They needed someone to come out and say, you know what, enough's enough. Now, whether that was Simon Goodwin dropping a big name at selection or something needed to break, because it felt that, and I know quite a few Melbourne supporters, that they're just going along and it's just meandering along and no one's getting angry, no one's getting emotional about it. Yes, some of the players have come out and said they're upset and whatnot, and Max Gawn sort of is the headline act for that. But there's not enough sort of anger, enough sort of mongrel in Melbourne, and maybe that's what the president needed to do, to come out and actually say, you know what, what's happening at the moment isn't good enough. We're aware of it, and we're trying to fix it, rather than Simon, who sort of just goes along and, yeah, look, it'll be okay, yeah, we're working on it. And I don't think Melbourne fans want more than that. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't know.
The problem is we're not going to get a true. We're not going to get a true read. They play Adelaide and North Melbourne in the next 2 weeks, so we all expect them to win by half form ladder.
But it's how they win, though, Rammer. It's they've got to come out and win decisively, like they did against Hawthorn. It's not about just getting the 4 points. It's playing a ruthless, attacking, put them away sort of brand of football.
But what you're saying is you believe against Adelaide we'll see the same setup and system as we have seen from Melbourne for the last couple of years. I would like to see personally just a little bit of a shuffle. Shuffle some magnets around, move guys into different positions, and just if you've got to change something, don't put the same out there. Change it. Actually change something.
Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about, circuit breaker. They need to do something different to get a spike.
Yeah, and I think further to that point, Whitey, is I think for Melbourne supporters and the frustration coming from that, when you go back to the year of their preliminary final, that there was a difference to Melbourne's DNA,
absolutely,
you know what I mean, of recent times.
Edge.
I'm not, I think it was, oh, we're seeing something different. This looks like a shift. I think that's where they're so angry and upset is because, well, that now is looking like an outlier.
That's right.
Season. Yeah.
Yeah.
But in that season, they had a ruthlessness. They had an edge to them. They played a bit angry. They had this real emotion about them. They were ruthless. Now, they weren't that before then, and they haven't been that after then. So what was it? They had something. They clearly didn't bottle it, but they've got to get back to that.
The coach of the Kangaroos, Reece Shaw, whose festival of football started magnificently with a big 69-point victory over the Adelaide Crows. Reece, good morning.
I'm happy. How are you going, mate?
Going very well, thank you, buddy. It's nice to wake up on a Monday, I imagine, with 4 points in the bank and a pretty strong performance by your boys. You must be very pleased.
Yeah, look, we've got a fair lean trot, but on the weekend we got some of our mojo back, which was really pleasing, and it's probably been the work over the last couple of weeks that has got us to that point. And it was just really, really good to see the boys play some really solid footy and something we can build upon going into the upcoming weeks.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Kangas fans would be happy about that as well. And for you and then the group, I suppose, Reece, a lot of change through the last probably 10 months or so. You full-time in the position, your own program that you've been running, then, of course, COVID hits and the whole world and footy world certainly is transformed into a very different place. And then you lose 6 in a row as a new coach. You start with great energy in the start of the season, and then you have this period of not negativity, but just not overly great emotions, I wouldn't imagine. How did you manage dealing with the players and yourself through that period?
Yeah, look, it's been an interesting 12 months. I won't deny that, but I think this is just what happens in AFL footy. And the ups and downs can be pretty drastic at stages, and I think we started the season really, really well. Obviously beat the Saints after coming back from a huge margin at halftime, and then to go up to GWS and play some really, really good footy and get the result there, and then to have 6 in a row on the flip side was very difficult. But I think I was really proud of the way we went about it. Even though we were accumulating the losses, the boys stuck together. We made sure that we identified the issues and tried to go about solving them, and I think the boys appreciated that, and credit to them, they just kept rolling out, and we lost four games by under 14 points as well, so that doesn't help the scenario. But I just think the way the guys are going about it, the way my coaching staff's going about it, has been fantastic, and it's taken a while, but we got the result that we wanted on the weekend.
Reece, we were talking earlier in the program about circuit breakers, and sometimes clubs need to go with a circuit breaker to get a spike in performance. You did that with Ben Brown and also Jared Pollock being dropped ahead of the game. Take us through that process, how you did it, how they accepted it, because that was pretty bold at selection.
Yeah, look, it's just one of those things. Oh, I think we've made some decisions over the last 6 weeks. And we've made changes to our team in that period. But the only ones that we're talking about right here are Brownie and Polly. And I think it was best for the individual and our team, and that's why we made that decision. And the boys have been fantastic. We've had some really good chats over the last couple of weeks where they sit, and I was really pleased with the response, and the guys understand what's required, and I've got no doubt they'll bounce back pretty quickly, and we've got no choice in our circumstances. We've got 2 4-day breaks coming up, so the squad's going to be tested, and our depth will play games, and that's a good thing, and give guys opportunity, but also they've got to come in and play a role for us.
Ben's an interesting one because he does look like a player down on confidence. How much of it was him needing to play better, and how much of it was contributed to the way the team was playing? Was that a difficult balance for you to determine?
Yeah, I think it's probably a bit of both. And Ben acknowledges the form he's in. And I also acknowledge that we're not playing that great footy, so that doesn't help a big key forward. So, but it just comes a time when you've just got to make those decisions. And as a match committee, we decided this was the week, and hopefully Ben got away from footy for a little bit, refreshed his mind, and I know that he'll come back really strong, because the one thing Ben Brown does is just work hard. He just works harder than anyone, so he'll leave no stone unturned, and hopefully we'll see him back really soon.
It was unbelievable to see the return of Magic Door on the weekend. I'm sure it's been building. It's been one of those moments that you've been looking forward to seeing for a long time, not just for your footy club, but for Madge, and to see him peg back, as Dermot Breton said beautifully on the weekend, his life, and get to the point where he can play AFL footy again. What does it mean for your club to see a guy like Madge get back from the brink of disaster, really, and we're all pretty clear on the situation, to be able to get out there again and play footy with his teammates?
Yeah, it's been an amazing journey, having only been here a couple of years, but to understand what he means to the group as a bloke, and he's such a great fella, he's a great teammate, but he's put a lot of work into himself off the field, and that's been necessary to get to where he has got to on the weekend from a football sense. We've always tried to look after our players as individuals first, and then worry about the footy secondary, and for him to get back out on the field was just an amazing feat, and we actually made him work for it. We probably could have played him a couple of weeks ago if we wanted to, but we made him work for it, and we put his head down, and so I think we got the right result in the end, and it was just fantastic to see. And I think after celebrating the goal, that's genuine joy from our boys, because they love him.
You've been around footy for a long time, Reece. Is it the most amazing moment you've been a part of?
Yeah, it would have to be one of the most amazing things I've experienced. when you sit down and look at all the setbacks he's had over the last couple of years, and the challenges that he's faced, and then to persist with great courage, it's just amazing. And full credit to Madge and his family and our footy club for the support they've given him.
Scotty Jamieson's big at the time. Melbourne City captain. They had a magnificent game on the weekend against Sydney FC. 2-0 over the league leaders. I'm sure he's pretty pumped about that. Scotty, good morning.
Good morning, boys.
Great to have you with us. Now, that's not a bad way to open up the books again after a long layoff. 2-0 over Sydney FC.
Nah, it was brilliant. Obviously, the Premier's crowned 2 weeks ago or last week. So, you know, going into the game, you know they're the best team at the moment, and yeah, we've come into it and really pleased. Been a long while between drinks. We've had a few stories to tell in between those drinks, that's for sure. So to get back out there, play as well as we did, was really pleasing.
So going into it, I mean, did you think you were sharp? Did you train well with the weeks preceding, looking pretty good on the track? Was it all organised really well? Did you go in confident?
Yeah, no, you were, look, to be honest with you, I thought, you know, in terms of preparation, it was good as can be. Apart from, you know, we weren't able to play games against anyone. You know, we hadn't had any friendlies as such. So that was, the worry. It wasn't really spoken about, but it was the worry. You can do as much training as you can, but match fitness is definitely one. But to be honest with you, the preparation in terms of training, our management, you know, who have looked after us, you know, the coaches, the fitness coaches, prepared us as well as we could have been. And, you know, maybe the winter, you know, change of, you know, playing in winter helped us too. I don't know. But, yeah, we were confident in the sense of the amount of training we've done, you know, the lead up to the game was very good. So, you know, would I say I expected that performance? Probably not, but, you know, I definitely expected a positive one, but that was really good.
So you say you expected that performance, Scotty, but can you take us into them? What did you do, you personally, obviously being the one of the leaders of the team, to make sure that that performance happened? Because the motivation levels of some guys have been really different around world sport in terms of the way they've come back. But then you as a leader, how did you make sure that the guys were really switched on?
Well, I think we just kind of put the emphasis on, you know, what's up for grabs, in regards to, you know, not hiding away from the fact that a second position gives us a big chance of first and foremost, a double chance of winning the grand final as such, but also, you know, Asia is an opportunity to get into Asia finishing second. So I think it was spoken about rather than, you know, trying to hide the fact or the elephant in the room that, you know, the expectations of this club is to first and foremost win trophies, but also be in Asia. So, you know, we've had that mentality of being open and honest about what we need to do, where we need to get to, and embracing that kind of pressure from within. But it was a case of just really working hard on deficiencies we thought we had prior to the COVID breakdown, and then going into the Sydney FC game. You know, we had a few scratch matches in between, and there was a, you know, it was quite intense, a good feeling about it. So I think that formulated into, you know, what happened on the weekend.
Before we let you go, Scotty, I just want to know, what was it like playing? You've waited so long, and we've talked to you along the journey of what you've been doing when you haven't been able to play. What was that feeling like to run out there with your mates and get things underway again?
Yeah, it was brilliant, mate. You know, I kind of forgot that, you know, there'd been no stands there. So you kind of going into it just, you know, happy as can be. And then, you know, playing at ANZ, it was obviously a great stadium, but with it being empty, it was a little bit different. But once you get back out there and, you know, the competitive juices get flowing, you know, the back and forth with opposition players gets going, you know, it's brilliant to be back. And hopefully, you know, in regards to, you know, our rest of our season, we can continue that way. And then with finals, there'll be some crowds and stuff back in. But, you know, it is what it is at the moment with no crowds. So we'll continue.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.